This is a CNA podcast.
In 5 words or fewer, how would you characterize Singapore's shift back to phase 2 heightened alert?
I would characterize the future as being about always prepared, always flexible. We just have to do our best and trust and be ready to for the curveballs that life will throw at us.
How's that 5 words?
There were four words, but with elaboration.
I'd define it as an unfortunate necessity. The end of the pandemic is near, and this will delay it a little, I think.
It's been barely 3 weeks since Singapore started talking about living normally with an endemic COVID. We were on the cusp of relaxing more rules, letting bigger groups gather. We were on the verge of that elusive new normal. And yet here we are, back in phase 2 heightened alert. Authorities took pains to explain on Tuesday that the explosion of cases in the fishery port and the KTVs was still seeding in the community, and some sort of a shutdown was needed. Do the curbs suggest, however, that we're further away from that new normal than we thought? What will it take to get there? And what's causing these goalposts to shift? I'm Lin Su Ling. It's Thursday, 22nd July, and you're listening to Heart of the Matter. Now, with me to talk through what's behind the latest rounds of restrictions are Dale Fisher, Senior Consultant at the Division of Infectious Disease, National University Hospital.
Hi, Su Ling.
And Jeremy Lim, Associate Professor at the NUS Saucy Hawk School of Public Health.
Hello, Su Ling.
Just to start off, right, Jeremy, why not let activities continue with those fully vaccinated? Singapore is already moving towards taking a differentiated approach to those vaccinated versus those who are not. And it seems somewhat sensible because vaccines reduce the risk of infection, transmission, and severe disease. So why not crack open the envelope? What's your take?
I would say that that's a very tempting and logical proposition, but it really depends on what the policymakers' risk appetite is. And here, as Minister Ong has really explained, that we are deeply concerned about the 200,000 seniors who have not been vaccinated. And the concern is really that even though the vaccinated have lower rates of infections, much lower rates of really severe disease, they can still be vectors and bring the disease back into their homes and affect the vulnerable seniors. I can understand that other countries have taken different approaches, but here in Singapore, the policymakers have elected to be more cautious, to be more conservative, and the appeal to the people was really to hang in there for a couple more weeks.
So just zooming in, one key contention really is dining in. What is it about dining in that's so risky, Dale, when weddings, worship services, people hang around a little bit longer, they can continue even with no pre-event testing? And also compared to, say, MICE activities or NDP that will go on. What is it about dining, though?
Well, obviously, the number one issue is the mask-free component of it. You can get people somewhat crowded, but most importantly, taking masks off, and it's a festive atmosphere. So naturally, there's going to be some laughter and speaking very loudly, perhaps calling out. So it is different in that respect. The other thing is the enforceability. If you're having a wedding or something, you can actually capture who's vaccinated, who's not vaccinated, whereas a hawker stall, there's not really an entrance where someone can oversee that. So probably the highest risk people at the moment, which are the elderly unvaccinated, these would be sites where these people would frequent.
But is there really no room to let those who are vaccinated dine in when so many F&B outlets and even hawker centres, they will have the necessary safe entry check-in? F&B restaurants have temperature screening even.
Let me chime in here. To be honest, I am very, very sympathetic to the F&B sectors. I'm also very sympathetic to those who have been vaccinated. And from a technical point of view, it is reasonable to make provisions for the group of vaccinated individuals who don't come into contact, don't have high-risk seniors who are unvaccinated in their households. There is a theoretical attractiveness that you can allow these guys to basically dine in twos and really so on. But the government has decided that it's just operationally very, very challenging. And I think before we moved into the phase 2 heightened alert again, we did have a set of very convoluted guidelines that very candidly, a lot of people were confused and some sitting clinics openly mocked that the government was just getting its knickers all really twisted in contorting the different permutations. So the right balance has got to be struck. And I come back to the point that the government decided to err on the side of caution and just say, let's just effectively minimize the risk as best we can by not even permitting dining.
Just want to really press the point though, everybody's safe entry traced together has actually a vaccination status there. So is it really that operationally challenging to enforce that? And given also that the choice here is dine in or not dine in rather than a certain complex permutation.
But then Suning, it is not checking whether the individuals have been vaccinated or otherwise. There's also the next step. Do these individuals come into regular contact with an unvaccinated senior? That's the complexity. It's not just assessing whether they have been vaccinated.
So definitely infection risk is one side of the coin in considering that. But the other side of the coin also is, would that differentiation between vaccinated and unvaccinated people be something good, especially in nudging those who have not signed up for a jab? I ask because in France, after the government made it compulsory for you to have a vaccination or a negative test to enter a bar, a restaurant, 1.7 million people signed up for the vaccination.
I think a lot of it comes down to enforceability. That you can see huge advantages in only letting vaccinated people in to any large gathering. But at a hawker stall, most of these don't have an opening. So you'd have to be walking around policing it, asking people to show their phones while they're in the middle of food, and it's tough. The other thing I think we're missing, though, is there is still a big threat. Our vaccination rate for two jabs will be over 70% in 3 or 4 weeks, but it's still currently around 50%. And as you pointed out, there's about 200,000 people over 70 that are still completely vulnerable. So we still do have the capacity to see a lot of deaths and to overwhelm hospitals. So even though we're so close, we aren't actually there yet.
So to be honest, I've been perplexed at the lack of harder nudges for the seniors who have elected to not be vaccinated. Mm. We are the nation that has a conscript military. We obligate every male to serve national service. National service has a small but definite risk of death as well as injury. But we as a nation, as a government, as a society, deem that this risk is necessary for the greater good. Given how prepared the government has been to push these necessary but unpopular measures for the greater good when they deem it as an existential issue, is really surprising that we have been so soft on the differentiation between the vaccinated and those who have not been vaccinated. Personally, I would have thought very hard about everything from lotteries to really differential privileges in dining and really right through to identifying households that have individuals who have not been vaccinated and essentially minimizing some of the contact, some of the privileges that these households would have.
Actually, Jeremy, are you saying that you think that vaccination should be made almost mandatory? Because you're proposing very strong nudges.
I'm not quite ready to say that we should mandate, but I do think that that should be on the government's policy radar. But at the very least, there should be substantially stronger nudges. And I think that what's happening in France, as you had described, Suling, is really one way to do it. And clearly, it's been effective. I do want to highlight that it's not just a personal choice to be unvaccinated. Those who elect to not be vaccinated do cause the rest of society to have our mobility and our privileges restricted. In the worst case scenario, as Dale had alluded to, if these individuals who are unvaccinated clog up the hospitals, clog up the ICUs, then there's a very real threat to the rest of Singapore that there may not be enough doctors, critical care beds and other facilities to care for them if they do have other diseases, because the heart attacks, the strokes and all, they still carry on with or without COVID.
Just one last question before I go back to Dale. Do you think that this need to get seniors vaccinated could have been reasonably foreseen, that we should have pushed harder on seniors if they are indeed the center of gravity here? Mobile vaccinations or outreach efforts should be made more aggressive earlier on?
Well, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, the answer is certainly yes. If we think back to how we launched the Pioneer Generation package and really other interventions that affected primarily the seniors, we were much more energetic about it. I would say that when it came to vaccination, there's a lot of confusion. We changed policies around allergies and who was suitable and who was not. And so given what we now know, we really should have been much more forceful, much more proactive back then.
Dale, Minister Ong Ye Kung had said on Tuesday, we have about 75% of seniors aged 70 and above in the bag based on bookings alone. But he's talked about reaching 75, 80, even 85%, and even before that, 90%. What is the difference that this gap between 70% and even 90% will make that won't overwhelm the healthcare system? That seems to be our concern right now.
You remember we used to speak a lot more about herd immunity, but that's not really the target now. Herd immunity really means that we've controlled transmission, and you can see by the number of vaccinated people with very mild disease that we will decrease transmission, but it's still going to happen quite a bit. So the role of vaccination really is to protect yourself, and the target has to be as many as possible. I don't think we could go the traditional herd immunity rate and say we're all safe now because we've got 70 or 80%. I think it's really about just getting as many people done as possible.
But why this focus on getting seniors aged 70 and above vaccinated? That seems to be the key thing right now.
Well, because they're the ones most likely to impact the health system. They're the ones most likely to get serious illness and die. So I'd much rather a lower rate in one of the younger age groups. But you can see from the curves of the vaccines that actually, as Jeremy was suggesting, that curve plateaued out some months ago. And it's not like it's suddenly stopped. It's really petered out. And it does take a concerted effort to suddenly make the shape of that curve go up. And if you look at the sort of one jab curve, you can see that the younger age groups are flying. They're going to end up at 90% in a couple of weeks, but we'll still be around 76 or something for the 70-year-olds.
And that's such a pity because they were the first group to be vaccinated. They were prioritized over everyone else. So the low vaccination rates were not something that only dawned upon us now. We knew this 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and it's a very reasonable question why we didn't push harder even as recently as 6-8 weeks ago. Could we be in a different position if the number of unvaccinated seniors wasn't 200,000, if it was 100,000? If we just do the math and if we take what Minister Ong shared, if let's say of the 200,000 and if 10% of them need hospitalization, then you're talking about 20,000 people. And if another 10% of those guys need oxygen or critical care, then there just aren't enough hospital beds in the entire country. So the concern is real. But my contention with the policies taken so far is why haven't we moved faster, earlier and more aggressively to get the highest risk groups vaccinated in much greater numbers?
But does it sound like we're walking back on the kind of metrics that we should be looking at? Because you recall a few weeks ago when there was talk about moving away from looking at daily infection numbers and maybe looking at ICU numbers. Now the rules have come down, but I think we've only have one in the ICU.
Given just how transmissible the Delta variant is, it's really a function of one's risk appetite because it's really anyone's guess of the 200,000 vulnerable seniors. What proportion are already staying home and minimizing contact with everyone else? From a policymaker point of view, do you take as the base case, the worst case scenario, or a more optimistic scenario? And depending on where your inclinations lie, will then determine what the national policies are.
The hospitals aren't being threatened now. There's about 300 people in acute hospitals, but most of those are there for isolation or for observation. There's, I think, today 8 that need oxygen and 1 in intensive care. So that's obviously tiny figures.
I mean, we're looking at this and making certain assumptions that seem to be worst-case scenarios. Do you think that Singapore has a much lower risk tolerance compared to other countries like UK, Israel and US? Does it seem like their calculation is different from ours?
I think Singapore has done an outstanding job through the pandemic. You talk about risk appetite. I think most of us would be pretty happy with their low risk appetite when you've seen so many people die elsewhere. You're quite right. There is a lower risk appetite. And they're going to have to take some deep breaths there. There's going to have to be some feeling a little bit of discomfort once we say we're no longer going to be contact tracing and quarantining. At what point do you start to do that? Mm. There's going to have to be a stepwise series of withdrawal of efforts over the next, I'd say, 3 or 4 months. I think they'll pull a few things back once we get to National Day. And then I think each month after that, they'll peel some more things back. And as long as we don't see hospitalizations and deaths spiraling out of control, yeah, they're going to have to be holding their nerves and having a few sleepless nights, I think, as they undo the restrictions. But we can't keep them there. There's too much social and economic pain going on, and government's very aware of that too, obviously.
Jeremy, would you call this a setback though? Because it really has been only weeks since we started talking about living normally with an endemic COVID. And there was even a blueprint surfaced by the 3 multi-ministry task force minister. And yet here we are, almost 180 degrees back into phase 2 heightened alert.
So I would say that this is a deeply disappointing setback. And I do put it squarely on the policymakers that the lower vaccination rates amongst the seniors could have been called out earlier. And I think from a communications point of view, expectations were really built up. And this notion of the 200,000 vulnerable seniors almost appeared like a curveball out of left field. People were thinking, okay, there are a couple outbreaks, big deal, but we have a plan towards COVID being endemic. And I think that the introduction of these new variables that policymakers need to take into consideration really resulted in a lot of disappointment. I would even say public anger. My own sense now is that, yes, we have a few critical weeks. The public needs to suck it up and just persevere. But I do hope that we see stronger plans to get the 200,000 vulnerable vaccinated. Because beyond the exhortations on social media and all by the politicians, it's not entirely clear to me what else is being done. And if we get to August 18th and this 200,000 vulnerable drop to 160,000, what then?
Jeremy, I didn't get a sense from you because on the one hand, you say that more could have been done, should have been done, and much earlier. But on the other hand also, the decision to shut down is one that depends a lot on our risk tolerance levels. Do you think that Singapore has a much lower risk tolerance level than other countries?
Yes, I think we have a much lower risk tolerance.
And rightly or wrongly though?
We are who we are, Suling. Right? We are the nation whose national identity is that of a little sampan being tossed and turned in a very hostile ocean. So I can understand the risk averseness. What I cannot understand is really why the vulnerable population wasn't flagged earlier and more done.
Dale, do you think that until we reach a stage where we can truly live normally with an endemic COVID, open and shut restrictions will be the new normal? And how long do you think we will take to get there?
I think there's going to be major changes in 3 or 4 weeks. And that's when about 25% more of the population will get their second jabs. It's going to be a huge change in the vaccination rates, at least for 2 jabs. It's just this heterogeneity, the laggards, if you like, the slow ones are the over 70s. I hear what Jeremy's saying. I think in fairness, they have been soft, but in fairness, there were some policies such as walk-in without an appointment, efforts to take vaccines to people with decreased mobility. So there have been some efforts in that regard, but obviously still very passive in a sense. And I think the Jeremy world of doing things more aggressively, I think that's going to get a lot more community buy-in going forward because people are tired of the restrictions. And if they can see the segment of the community that's in some ways responsible for them, then I think Jeremy's approaches could get quite popular.
Well, Dale, it's well known in the behavioral sciences that loss aversion is a much greater motivator than the prospect of gain. So the soft nudges, as you had described, making it easy to be vaccinated, are more around, they really fall in the spectrum of personal gain, making it easy to do the right thing. But you don't actually lose anything. But if we follow the example of France, difficulties in public transportation, dining out, and really so on, then there is genuine loss. And I suspect that that may eventually be necessary to tip us over that really critical threshold where we're not concerned about hospitals being overwhelmed, we're not concerned about hundreds or thousands of deaths.
So speaking of doing the right thing, one question I have for both of you is, does opening up also mean that we have to factor in potential vice activities like the KTVs and who knows what was continuing under the radar? I ask because there are huge healthcare and economic costs of infections, but the reality is if vice was part of the pre-pandemic old normal, wouldn't it be part of the post-pandemic new normal? What do you think? Do you think that also then maybe penalties for such illegal gatherings be stiffer? From a public health perspective, of course.
I think we're going to go back to something a lot more normal than people think. I think there'll be very few measures that will remain because of all the outbreaks I've been in, we often do interventions and think, this infection control system that we've now instituted in the country will be a good outcome, which will be sustainable. Things always go back to the way they were. I think some things will remain. I think like work from home, flexible work hours, don't go to work if you're sick. Some of these types of things will remain, but I think virtually everything, sadly or happily, will virtually revert.
Dale's totally avoiding the question. What about you, Jeremy?
I think vice will always be with us. If we think back to prohibition in the US 100 years ago, we cannot legislate away vice. And in fairness, COVID-19 and the safe distancing measures have been terribly isolating for many, many people. Even in a pre-pandemic world, the KTV lounges and so on, they really had their role to play in providing an outlet for entertainment and really so on. So I would say they will continue to be. And if policymakers are pressed too hard with the aggressive measures, introduce caning for any discrepancies or any illegal activities, then we force issues underground much more. And then this may make detection and so on difficult. But what I do hope is that policymakers work with the enforcement agencies to be a lot smarter about tracking what is going on so that we know when is the appropriate time to take action sooner rather than later. And I'm certainly hoping that in an endemic COVID world, the enforcement agencies, even clever things like tracking of alcohol sales from the suppliers and so on, many of these can give us a better leading indicators and prepare us for essentially any necessary actions that will need to be taken.
I just want to round off with one question, really. Like, even if we move towards an endemic COVID and living normally, whatever that means, how long can that strategy hold? And is it clear how long protection from COVID, say the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, will last without significant waning? What's your take?
The take on vaccines is the school's still out. There's a general feeling that either the vaccine will wear off or there'll be enough drifting away from the current genetics of the existing variants such that the vaccine becomes less effective against future variants. So I think we will need boosters, and that's why we'll need to keep observing both vaccinated people getting sick. That would obviously be a flag of a potential problem. There's also work you can do at a laboratory level to see if neutralizing antibody levels are falling with time. There's a lot of conflicting evidence in all this, but everyone's very aware that we need to track the vaccine performance.
But if that is in question, though, Dale, do you think that that means living normally with endemic COVID could mean shifting goalposts?
No, I think we just need to be aware and be ahead of the game. And I think we do this with flu, obviously, that the vaccine changes every 6 months based on the latest information. It doesn't have to go through all the clinical trials again because it's just a tweak, and we stay ahead of it in that way.
So, Jeremy, take us home. What do you think that post-pandemic future looks like for Singapore, and how far are we away from that?
I do share Dale's optimism that it's a matter of weeks. It'll be very, very painful couple of weeks, but it is a matter of weeks. And I think that in an endemic world, we will continue to wear masks for a very long time. We will continue to have restraints on the number of people who can meet, but it certainly won't be zero and it won't be two. And I think that the government, not just here in Singapore, but around the world, will be much, much more serious about biosurveillance and doing the measures that Dale had alluded to earlier in tracking mutations, checking the immune function from really vaccination. So overall, I am optimistic that the outlook, it is positive, but it's going to be lumpy. There will be ups and downs, but overall, I think we will get out of this. We are the human race, we always have, and fingers crossed, we always will.
Dale, Jeremy, thanks. This has been Heart of the Matter, brought to you by Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. I'm Lynn Suling, signing off until next time.